KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up this morning on Forum, the Obama administration revealed last week that it will be sending off to Congress for approval a $60 billion sale of arms to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That's the biggest U.S. arms deal ever. The administration is also in talks with the Saudis about potential naval and missile defense upgrades. How much of the deal with the Saudis is about jobs and how much about the balance of power and American interests in the Middle East, including Iran and that nation's likely going nuclear? We'll take all that up. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The Obama administration has put together a $60 billion arms package of fighter jets and helicopters for sale over 5 to 10 years to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the biggest U.S. arms sale of all time. The deal would create an estimated 75,000 jobs, and it would keep Saudi Arabia more militarily strong against the presumed threat of Iranian power in the region. This Forum hour, we want to focus on the arms sale to the Saudis and what it means, as well as what it may mean. And joining us from New York City is Jonathan Tepperman, who did an article about this in the most recent issue, actually the previous most recent issue of The Atlantic. In fact, he's a columnist, online columnist at Atlantic Magazine and managing editor and director of the Eurasia Group. They're a global political risk consulting firm. And welcome, Jonathan Tepperman.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Good to have you. Also good to have Steve Weber, who is professor of political science at UC Berkeley, author of The End of Arrogance, America and the Global Competition of Ideas. And he joins us this morning from Berkeley. Welcome, Steve Weber.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And let me begin, if I may, Jonathan Tepperman, with you. You see this as a real shift in U.S. Posture toward Iran dealing, I mean, that really is all about Iran and all about shifting rollback to containment. So explain that a little bit for listeners, what you're talking about.
Well, I think first of all, that there's no question that this is all about Iran. And in fact, the administration made this clear last week in discussing the sale. An administration official told the New York Times that this is all about making clear to the Iranians that nuclear program or no nuclear program, they can't throw their weight around in the Gulf. But reading between the lines, what I argued in my piece, that this massive, both the fact of the sale itself and the nature of the weapons that the United States is selling to Saudi Arabia suggests a subtle shift in U.S. policy towards Iran. But in between these two terms, which I use in the piece, rollback and containment, and these are terms borrowed from the Cold War. And what it really amounts to is a difference between trying to eliminate Iran or prevent Iran from getting a nuclear program and trying to deal with Iran once it's actually gone nuclear. And the reason that I make this distinction and the reason that I think that the weapons that we're selling Saudi Arabia betray the shift in policy is that a lot of what we're the United States is at least proposing to sell the Saudis are defensive weapons like the THAAD anti-ballistic missile program and the and an upgrade to their Patriot missile programs. These are designed for one thing, which is to knock down missiles coming at you. And we wouldn't be doing this unless we and the Saudis were getting ready to guard against a nuclear Iran.
Now, you also say in the piece that notwithstanding the fact that in past sales of arms to the Saudis, there had been a good deal of consternation and concern and up on the Hill from the Israeli lobby, that Israel and its supporters have been pretty quiet about all this.
Well, yeah, and that's a very interesting part of this entire dynamic because there is a lot of it's a very tricky proposition to shift from for the administration to shift from rollback to containment. The administration's policy very explicitly is the administration I should say is very explicit on this question. Washington has said that they will not, under any circumstance, tolerate Iran getting nuclear weapons. So they cannot be seen to be shifting to a policy that is preparing to deal with a nuclear Iran. There are several reasons for that. One, because they'll be attacked by American conservatives. But the other reason for it is because it raises the fear that The Israelis will try to take matters into their own hands. So one of the curious things about this move is that, so far at least, the Israelis aren't preparing to do that, and they seem to be acquiescing to the Saudi arms sale. Now, one of the reasons for it is that the Israelis don't feel personally threatened by the Saudi weapons. In the past, you know, major arms sales to Arab states worried the Israelis for their own security. And one interesting side story here is that this is a sign of how far we've come in terms of Israeli-Arab relations, that there's really no threat of a major conflict between most Arab and between Israel and most Israeli states anymore.
Well, forgive me, but also we're selling jets to the Saudis that lack the long-range missile systems and have a lower grade than the ones that are sold to the Israelis.
Well, exactly. That's the other part of the package. But we must have also said something to the Israelis to convince them that we are still very much focused on trying to prevent Iran from getting the bomb, notwithstanding the fact that we're also, at the same time, doing things that look like we're preparing for the eventuality that they may get a nuclear weapon.
Still, as you see it, a high-stakes gamble, really.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's one of these impossible dilemmas in foreign policy and diplomacy. I think that there's almost no question, or at least a very high likelihood, that Iran will get nuclear weapons, and yet, if you are seen to prepare for that eventuality, it will have very negative consequences.
And Jonathan Tepperman with us from New York, managing editor and director of the Eurasia Group, a global political risk consulting firm, and also an online columnist at Atlantic Magazine. Steve Weber is a professor of political science at UC Berkeley and author of The End of Arrogance, America and the Global Competition of Ideas. And Steve, I know you see this somewhat differently. In fact, I think you characterize it as being silly and more about Northrop and Lockheed and Boeing and GE and getting defense U.S. jobs.
Well, yeah, Michael, I have a hard time actually understanding the overall strategic logic vis-a-vis Iran. I mean, I have a different view on this than Jonathan does. I think I think I'm going to do what, you know, one should almost never do on the radio, which is make a prediction. And the prediction is that the Iranians are not going to achieve a nuclear capacity in this decade. I think the Israelis have made it very clear and continue to take the position that they will, if the United States does not act to prevent Iran, they will act on their own. I don't think we want to get into a long argument about whether or not that's a good idea or a bad idea, or how much impact it would actually have on the Iranians' nuclear facilities, but I think that the reality is present in that case. I don't understand really how, in any case, this particular sale of weapons to the Saudis would meaningfully bolster their defense capabilities vis-a-vis Iran with a nuclear weapon. I think the Saudis and others in the region take the position that if Iran goes nuclear, they will likely have to do so as well. And I understand why the United States would be at pains to try to stop that kind of proliferation regime sort of evolving in the Middle East. We've tried to do that for many, many years. So I understand why we'd want to sell the weapons. I'm not sure that I understand why the Saudis would want to buy them. I'll take one more position on this vis-a-vis the Saudi regime. I mean, if we're truly worried, as we have been for some time, of course, about the stability of the ruling House of Saud, we ought to be helping them deal with what is the real threat to their security, which is not actually an external threat, but is, in fact, the internal threat of the demographic time bomb that is evolving in Saudi Arabia. And this is a country with a vast, vast number of young, unemployed males who essentially have nothing to do. They have no jobs. There's no hope. There's no interest. It's an extremely boring place, quite frankly.
So instead of providing them jobs, we're providing American contractors jobs.
Well, look, I mean, we're coming up into an election season with an unemployment rate that's close to 10%.
That's 10% in Saudi Arabia, too.
Yeah, but the Saudis don't get to vote in our elections. So, you know, I don't want to be cynical about this, and I don't want to take the position of the military-industrial complex sort of argument, but I do think that, you know, look, I mean, you said it in your opening piece, 75,000 jobs. These are good-paying jobs. They're manufacturing jobs. They're jobs largely located in the Middle West. I mean, this is exactly the kind of jobs program that the administration needs. So, you know, look, in the long term, the strategic implications ought to be governing the way in which people think about this stuff. But I'm quite sure that the jobs issue is right up there at front.
Well, it may be indeed, and we'll get some other perspective on this as the hour other perspectives on this as the hour progresses. But what if there is not so much the external threat of Iran where Saudi Arabia is concerned? I'm wondering why they're upgrading these Patriots. That would presumably be to diminish the threat of Iranian rockets, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, there's some capability against those systems, but I think we also know that from our experience, actually, in the Gulf War, that the Patriot systems and the sort of follow-on THAAD systems are remarkably easy to defeat. In any case, it's kind of hard for me to see why it is that if the Iranians had a nuclear weapon or some small nuclear arsenal, which, as I said, I do not think they will have in this decade, that they would choose to use that against Saudi Arabia. What would be the reasoning behind that? And finally, let me make one last point about this. I mean, I think that, look, we have shown, and by I say we, I mean the United States, have shown that it is our committed, determined interest to defend our access to Saudi oil supplies. That's fundamentally the only real, true, big strategic interest we have in Saudi Arabia. We showed during the first Gulf War that we were not going to permit anyone to deny us access, even potentially deny us access to those oil reserves. So it's my view that if, in fact, a change in the balance of the power in the Middle East or even an event were to place at risk America's ability to access that, you know, lovely $3 a barrel oil that bubbles up in the eastern province, that we would not rely on the domestic military of Saudi Arabia, which is really quite weak, particularly in terms of its manpower, to defend those assets, but we would be there with our own soldiers.
I'd like to get some response from you, Jonathan Tepperman, what you're hearing from Professor Weber. Steve Weber seems to think this is more about jobs than it is about Iran.
Well, I hate to do this because I know that conflict makes for a good radio, but I'm afraid I agree with Steve and almost everything that he's just said.
You're in public radio. We don't have to admit conflict here.
I think he's made some excellent points, and I would just add a couple things to what he said. I think that he's absolutely right that the likelihood of an Israeli strike is actually quite high. I'm slightly more pessimistic about the chances of Iran nonetheless acquiring nuclear weapons, but we can agree to disagree about that. I think the chances of an Iranian strike on Saudi Arabia are extremely low, because one thing that we haven't mentioned, but of course we have to remember, is the two holiest sites in all of Islam are in Saudi Arabia. So the idea of a theocratic regime striking a country that is home to those two sites is almost unimaginable. Nonetheless, the Saudis are worried, and despite the fact that the systems that they're buying are not particularly effective, the Saudis think that they are, and what we're selling them or proposing to sell them is peace of mind. And they're not just worried about a nuclear strike. I think what they're much more worried about is that once the Iranians acquire a nuclear weapon or come close to acquiring a weapon, they'll become much more boisterous and aggressive, and that the shield provided to them by their nuke will make them more adventurous in all kinds of other ways. And the Saudis think that by arming themselves to the gills, they will be able to go toe-to-toe with the Iranians and stand them down. Now, whether that calculus actually makes sense, I agree with Steve. I'm not at all sure, especially given the fact that the Saudi military has shown itself to be far from capable in the past. And again, I agree with Steve that if there were a real threat to the Saudi oil fields, there's no question that the U.S. military wouldn't leave it to the Saudis, but would step in and do the job itself.
But Steve Weber, wouldn't you concede that there is a real power struggle now in the Middle East between the Saudi kingdom that sees itself as Sunni leaders and their own Wahhabi brand of Islam, theocratically, with Iran, which is Shiite. And for the most part, these two are really at loggerheads.
Yeah, I absolutely do, Michael. But I think I want to add to that another power struggle that's emerging in the Middle East right now, which is probably less commented on here in the United States, but I think in some ways more profound and of greater importance to us, which is the power struggle between the United States and the Chinese. You know, one of the sort of not well-known factoids is that as of last year, the Saudis are actually selling more oil to the Chinese than they are to the United States. And, I mean, we've all been aware of the fact that the Chinese, sort of like looking under the lamppost when you're drunk for your keys, are in the Middle East because that's where the oil is, and they need access to that oil. But I think we're not fully aware of the degree to which the Chinese have sort of turned that into a broader strategy of competing for influence in the region with the United States. Now, for a long time, as you know, dating back to 1973 most profoundly, when we had this discussion with the Russians, and I use the term discussion, you know, kind of facetiously, the United States has taken the position that at the end of the day, we are the external power that makes the rules and sets the regimes in the Middle East. The United States sees itself that way, and we're not willing to share that role with anyone. We made that very clear to the Russians in 1973. And I feel that part of our arrangement with Riyadh now is to compensate them for the kind of work and the kind of infrastructure assets and the kind of other investments the Chinese are making in the region by offering them the one thing that we can offer them that the Chinese really can't at the same level, and that is advanced weaponry.
Again, Steve Weber with us from Berkeley is professor of political science. We're going to go, actually, to Saudi Arabia to talk with the editor-in-chief of Arab News, which is a Saudi English-language daily newspaper, Khalid Al-Maina, and he joins us this morning, I guess, from Riyadh, aren't you?
From Jeddah.
From Jeddah, excuse me. Okay. We're glad to have you with us. I wonder how this is being played out in the kingdom. I mean, I know there's a good deal of concern over cost and particularly over the outdated F-15s because the Israelis have F-35s. But there's also the point that Professor Weber made that you have all these young Saudi youth who are unemployed, and concern must be, I think, characteristic now of feelings that are running high in Saudi Arabia about why aren't we putting them to work? Why are we putting Americans to work?
Well, I think that could be a concern, yes. But at the same time, I would like, I think, to update its weaponry. But in most of the contracts now, I don't know if I hope I'm right this time, too, is that with weaponry also, there were training programs, there were industrial programs that were added the program when it happened when we bought for the first time the F-15s. Now, I do agree. Personally, I think is that with these weapons, are they defensive? Are they offensive? We hear that they are defensive weapons, and some of them are not fitted enough to cross the border. That's besides the point. But I was just listening to the professor. I mean, you know, we are not pawns. I mean, for example, that if America doesn't want China to intrude in the area, I think people are looking at their own self-interest. Yes, I agree that I was taken aback by the size of the arms deal. Is it going? It's not a one-shot thing. I think it's going to go over for a couple of years because you can't buy all this and put it in a garage. You need training facilities. You need Saudis also to do it because you can't hire, gunslingers from outside to do a job for you.
We seem to have a kind of crackly connection here, so I wanted to just get to one other important question with you, if I may, Khalid Al-Maina, and that is the whole question of succession. The Saudi king is quite elderly, and his half-brother, the crown prince, Sultan, is in his 80s and ill. The next in line, as I understand it, would be Prince Naif, who is at least described here in the West as being very anti-Western. In fact, I believe he declared that 9/11 was a Zionist conspiracy. Could I get you to comment on that?
Well, I don't think so. There are many things that were set out of context. But let me tell you one thing. Whoever becomes king, first of all, has to have the prime interest of the people. As you said, there are a lot of young people out there. They're not all James Deans, but believe me, these people want a piece of the pie. They want to participate in nation building. They want to be members in a decision-making process of Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabia of the next 5 years is not going to be the Saudi Arabia of today. And anybody who's king, whether or prime minister or crown prince, realizes this. As such, see a change in the last 2 or 3 years, including a woman or including.
Okay. Again, unfortunately, the connection is not as good. But Khalid Al-Maina, thank you so much for joining us. Khalid Al-Maina is the editor in chief of the Arab News, a Saudi English language daily newspaper. I wonder, Jonathan Teberman, if you want to comment on what you just heard. I mean, this is the Saudi English language newspaper editor-in-chief, and he's saying, in effect, that the United States shouldn't be concerned about succession, that things will continue to be very allied between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
I wish I could be comforted by that, but unfortunately I'm not, because as we know, and as you yourself stated, the king is old. The crown prince is, while younger than the king, is, I believe, is much sicker than Abdullah, and Naif. I think it's hard to argue that his statements have been taken out of context, and it seems pretty clear that he's no friend of the United States. What is inarguable is that this entire generation of princes are in their late 70s and 80s and won't be around much longer, and there's not much clarity about the younger generation who will be, one way or another, succeeding them pretty soon. And that's if everything goes according to plan. And given the tremendously destabilizing forces at work in Saudi Arabia, the huge youth boom that Professor Weber identified earlier, the massive youth discontent, the serious unemployment, the significant religious or sectarian tensions within the country. You know, this is not a stable country, and so this adds to the, when we're talking about the disadvantages of this arms sale, we have to put this on the con side as well. This is, you know, not a stable ally. It's quite a precarious one, and so we, you know, we have to think about the fact that all of these pretty high-tech weapons that we're selling could wind up in the hands of a regime that we may not be so comfortable with.
Now that I think absolutely needs to be part of the equation. And as we're coming up on a break here, Steve Weber, I'd like to get some insight from you about the fact that maybe some of this arms sale has to do with the threat from Yemen, the terrorists across the border from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think that's clear, Michael. I mean, there's been a real shift in concern inside the U.S. administration. As you know, away to some degree from Afghanistan, away even from Pakistan and towards places like Yemen and Somalia, I think, again, there's a great deal of skepticism in Washington and justified skepticism about the just the physical and particularly the manpower ability of the Saudi army to deal with that stuff. And most of these weapons, you know, are not going to be terribly useful against al-Qaeda cells located in Yemen. They could be used to defend the border, and I think that that, you know, is an important issue. But in the long run, as I think, you know, Jonathan pointed to very, very carefully, I mean, this is a conversation we've been having in the United States for as long as I've been around, the instability of the House of Saud and our dependence upon them. Fundamentally, though, you know, I don't want to sound like Tom Friedman, but I will for a minute. I mean, this is an oil issue at the end of the day. And to some degree, the Saudis also buy a lot of our treasury bonds, so it's also a financial issue. But fundamentally, this is an oil issue. It just adds to the pressure on the United States to deal with that oil dependency question.
All right, we're dependent on the time here because we're coming up on a break here, but we will come back with Steve Weber and Jonathan Tepperman and you. In fact, you're invited to join us, and we cordially invite you now to join the program if you have questions or comments. We welcome them. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, to join our program, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the fact that last week President Obama put forward a massive $60 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia. That's the largest U.S. arms deal ever. The package may be less about arms to the Saudis and more about deterring Iran, and detractors say it's overkill at best, and at worst, it may further incentivize Iran's nuclear program. We're talking about the risks and the benefits and talking with Steve Weber, who's professor of political science at UC Berkeley, author of The End of Arrogance, America and the Global Competition of Ideas, and also with Jonathan Tepperman, who did an article about this in last month's Atlantic. He's managing editor and director of the Eurasia Group, a global political risk consulting firm, and an online columnist at Atlantic Magazine. You can join the program with your thoughts, questions, or comments. Again, toll-free number available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. Or join us online with your comments or questions by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. We also spoke earlier with Khalid Al-Marino, who is the editor-in-chief of the Arab News, a Saudi English-language daily newspaper, looking at an email from a listener, Byron in La Honda, who says, let's be clear from the start, this is all about corporate profits, and Iran is only the current drama. And Jonathan Tepperman, you would say what to that?
It is about corporate profits. It is about jobs. It is about Iran. It is about Saudi Arabia. I think you can't exclude any of those factors.
Steve Weber, want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, look, corporate profits right now are at an all-time high in the United States as percentage of GDP. So this, in the long run, is a small fillip for them. It's about all those things, as Jonathan said.
And also, as you've been saying, Steve Weber, about jobs, because it certainly helps in the political fights coming up to say that 75,000 jobs were obtained, or to bring those numbers up. It may be a blip in the overall picture of unemployment, but there it is.
No, it matters. I mean, remember, Bob Gates at the Pentagon has been talking quite openly about a small but significant reduction in the Pentagon budget. I mean, he's actually the one who's calling for a sort of 2% reduction. Now, that may not sound like a lot. But in fact, for people in the defense industry, it feels like a lot. So, you know, there's a bargain going on there as well.
Right. And one other factoid that I'd throw out is that, which is interesting to note, is that because of the global recession, U.S. arms sales are down 9% over the last 2 years, which is one of the biggest drops in recent memory. Now, I'm certainly no conspiracy theorist, and I'd be the last person to argue that that has anything to do with this sale, but it's an interesting contrast.
It's certainly an interesting statistic, as you pointed out. Brad Sherman is a member of the House of Representatives, congressman from the 27th District in the San Fernando Valley, a Democrat, and he sits on the Committee on Foreign Affairs, as well as the Subcommittee on the Middle East and South Asia, which has jurisdiction over this issue. We welcome him to the program. Congressman Sherman, good to have you.
Good to be with you, Michael.
I'd like to ask you about the likelihood of congressional approval of this deal. We've got Ahmadinejad visiting the United States now, and if it is, as our guests are saying, or has a lot to do with Iran, this would be probably a good time to get congressional approval.
Well, I don't think Congress can or should just rubber stamp this. We've got to look carefully at the avionics that are on the F-15s, and we have to look at making enforceable appropriate agreements on where these weapons are going to be based. Are they going to be facing Iran, or are they going to be just a few miles from Israel? And this is the time to get solid promises from Saudi as to how their citizens and in some cases official government agencies are funding some of the most radical terrorists in the world. And we need to, this is not just an agreement to deliver the weapons. This is also an agreement that relates to spare parts, maintenance, and servicing. And we need to be in a position to turn off the maintenance and the servicing if the Saudis breach their agreements to us.
Well, I suppose you lawmakers could change things or even block this, although that's not anticipated. But you mentioned a few miles from Israel, and we've been talking about the fact that Israel doesn't seem to be as concerned about this as they have been in the past about Saudi weaponry.
Well, I think Israel's concerned, but there are two other aspects. First, to what extent are they willing to be publicly opposed to something that the administration wants, given the other business they're doing with the administration? And then second, this is not unrelated in time to a deal to sell weapons to Israel, which are important to meet Israel's qualitative advantage. I think certainly in Congress, the weapons deal for Israel goes through easily. I think that just because the Israeli government may, for those reasons, be silent, doesn't mean that there is no adverse effect on Israel national security when the Saudis, which is a somewhat unstable government, you don't know who's going to be there 5 or 10 years from now. I remember us providing weapons to the Shah, only to find those weapons in other hands.
Yeah, we spoke earlier about the concern about Prince Nayef, who is quickly going to be in line if the Crown Prince, Sultan, is too ill or, well, he's in his 80s and so forth. And he's decidedly anti-Western.
And we also have to be concerned about perhaps Saudi Arabia letting people unfriendly to us take a look at these weapons and on a detailed basis. This is not our most advanced technology, but it's still not anything we want the Chinese looking at too carefully.
Brad Sherman, again, is congressman for the 27th District, San Fernando Valley, and sits on the Committee on Foreign Affairs. Thank you so much, Congressman.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. I ought to mention, by the way, that the $60 billion sale, Jonathan Tepperman outlines this in his article in The Atlantic, would include 84 F-15 fighter planes, 70 Apache attack helicopters, 72 Black Hawk troop transport helicopters, and 36 Little Bird surveillance copters. And again, that would pretty much eclipse about any deal that's been made in the past as far as arms deals. Let me bring our callers into this. And Robert, you're up first here. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. One thing that I wanted to mention, which none of the guests have mentioned, is the strategic vision of Iran and of the Iranian Revolution, which is one global Islamic community with Iran in the leadership. And that's their strategic vision, and they will project power and try to accomplish that whether they have a nuclear bomb or not. They already have veto power in Lebanon's politics through Hezbollah. They have quite a bit of influence in Gaza through Hamas, and they're creating problems for Egypt through Hamas. So this is a major, major concern for all Arab regimes, with the possible exception of the regime in Iraq, which is Shiite. And this is what is a major concern for all Arab countries in the region.
I think Robert's analysis is spot on, Jonathan Tepperman. I mean, there is a great deal of concern in the Arab world now in these, for the most part, autocratic-run countries in the Arab world that Iran, another autocracy, wants hegemony.
I think that there are a lot of there's a lot of truth to what your caller has said, and the Arab states are certainly petrified. And I'd emphasize a point that I made at the beginning of our conversation, which is one of the lesser told but fascinating aspects of this entire story is the way that from the beginning of Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon, it's brought Israel and the moderate Arab Sunni states together, that it's really ended the prospect of war between Israel and the moderate Arab Sunni regimes, because their only concern now is Iran. They're really not at all concerned with Israel and the prospect of war between Israel and not just Egypt and Jordan, but Saudi and Lebanon, because of Hezbollah, is a different picture, but is practically nil. But I'd make one other point, which is that influence and war are a very different thing. And while it's probably true that Iran is looking to expand its influence, because the Iranians, I'd argue that the picture is a lot older than the revolution, that Iran is an imperial culture and has an imperial view of itself and the region that goes back more than 1,000 years. I think it's also important to recognize that Iran's behavior over the last 20, 30, 40 years is really of what political scientists call a status quo power, that Iran is not really, despite the nature of its own regime, revolutionary beyond its borders, has not picked a major fight or started a war since 1979. And the likelihood of them actually starting a shooting conflict with another state, I think, is actually pretty low. Now, I know it doesn't comfort the Israelis when I say this to them, nor does it comfort the other Sunni Arab states. And it's easy to say that from a comfortable perch in the United States, but just looking at Iran's behavior, it's pretty hard for me to imagine them starting an actual war.
Well, apropos of that, Mahmoud Manshapouri is Associate Professor of International Relations at San Francisco State. He specializes in the Middle East and follows Iranian politics closely and is an Iranian, and joins us this morning. Good morning, Professor Manshapouri.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you on. I'd like to get your analysis on this about Iran's ambitions. They're certainly posturing as the defender of the Palestinians, and they have taken a major role in Hamas and in Lebanon and Hezbollah. Just how do you see these ambitions, particularly where the other Arab states are concerned, and they are indeed concerned?
Yes, Michael, thank you so much. This is a very stimulating discussion. I've been listening here and learning a lot. I just want to, before answering this question, just can I make a comment with regard to the point that Jonathan made, that absolutely right. I mean, since the middle of 18th century, Iran has never invaded its neighbors. We don't have any history of Iran having sort of an offensive plan here. And with regard to whether or not Iran is unlikely to attack Saudi, because Saudi is the host to two holy shrines, I would add that Iran is not adventurous, not because of the holy shrines, but because they don't really have any interest in invading Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a huge country, one-third continental USA. They don't have any plan to do that. They have no interest to do that. And someone says if Iran goes nuclear, it makes Iran less adventurous and very cautious because they are in a position that they can actually commit a huge mistake, and the ramifications of that would be grave. One of your callers called and said, Iran has a global strategic plan. This is nonsense. Iran does not have any global strategic plan. Iran has a regional plan. Iran has always been a very dominant player in the Persian Gulf region. They want to stay a dominant regional player, but they don't have any global strategic plan. If Iranians can take care of their employment, unemployment, and traffic, they will be pretty darn happy. They don't have any global strategic plan. But let me answer your question. Definitely Iranians are looking at this arms deal as something that it forces them to strengthen their air defense system. I haven't really seen any sort of official statement coming from the Iranian government in reaction to that deal. But I mean, looking at some of the semi-official news agency Mehr News, they're looking at it differently. They're saying that if this armed deals supports Saudi, well, this is great because Saudi ultimately is not a friend of Israel, and that's the way they look at it. Rather, they see Saudi on their side because they see a lot of sort of common interest in stability in the region. With regard to the Palestinian
issue, mean despite the division between the Shiite and Sunni ways of thinking?
Well, I don't think that Iranians really playing on this Shia-Sunni divide. They do not have any interest to actually intensify this divisive issues between them. Rather, they look at the Saudi strengths not in, of course they do have competitions with Saudi within the Persian Gulf region, but nevertheless, the one view that they have is that the Saudi is never going to be the friend of Israel, so strengthening Saudi for them is for their based calculations, rightly or wrongly, that is something that strengthens Saudi, but Saudi is not actually considered to be a friend. Rather, it's a competitor, regional competitor with Israel. That's one perspective, somewhat sort of odd, but it's coming from the Iranian side. But with regard to the Hamas and the Lebanon, Iranians have always had this trump card that they have played it at the times when they have to, and they consider that to be ace in their hands, and that way they actually win the hearts and minds of the Arab streets. And that is a card that Ahmadinejad has played very skillfully and shrewdly. But it is not really related to the arms deal to the Saudi. They have always had this plan. Ever since 1979, Iranians have actually supported the Lebanon and the Palestinians' cause.
Mahmoud Manchapouri, again joining us this morning, Associate Professor of International Relations at San Francisco State University. Thank you so much, Professor Manchapouri.
My pleasure.
Good to hear from you this morning. Let's hear from more of our listeners. We'll go to Oakland. William, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to say that it seems to me that this arms deal is something that will motivate the Iranians to go farther and faster in pursuing a nuclear deterrent. And it's just one aspect of a sort of schizophrenic policy on the part of America, which on the one hand tries to assure the Iranians that they have nothing to worry about, that we are not have no intention of invading them and changing their regime, and on the other hand, not objecting to Israel's threats to Iran, and being quiet about keeping all the options on the table in terms of a military might against Iran. So I think the drive to find a nuclear deterrent because of such a sort of schizophrenic approach is inevitable.
All right. I thank you for the call. I want to go to some of your emails here, which sort of dovetail with that call. JB writes, although the arms sale might give Iran cover for their nuclear program, to suggest it will accelerate the program or conversely that killing the arms sale would impede it is ridiculous. The only thing that will slow Iran's nuclear program is sustained military action. And Tim from South San Francisco, addressing some of your comments, Steve Weber, says, I had a comment to the professor's doubt that Iran has any strategic reason to attack Saudi Arabia. It's true that the country is home to the holiest sites in Islam, but the Iranian regime may think of the House of Saud as false Muslims and puppets of the West. So they are justified to attack as long as they don't directly strike Mecca and Medina, but the oil infrastructure and Riyadh instead. Iran has incentive to target Saudi Arabia as a way of indirectly hurting the West. By disrupting or threatening the global oil supply, Iran has much more leverage. But in general, I doubt that Iran has offensive purposes for the nukes, but rather a deterrent against U.S. and Israeli aggression. Steve Weber?
Look, Michael, let's bring in this question about regime change in Iran and U.S. policy with regard to that. I mean, the Obama administration has somewhat softened its rhetoric on that. The Bush administration had done that gradually over the course of the time it was in power. But I think there's very little question in anyone's mind in the region, or frankly for that matter in Washington, that it would be very much in the United States' interest to see a regime change in Iran. I mean, we made it very clear our support for the Green Revolution, as small as that was. So I think, you know, there is a degree to which, you know, our interests are quite open on that score, and the Iranians clearly understand that. With regard to this issue about the acceleration of an arms race in the region, I mean, I think we ought to be clear about this. There already is a massive arms race in the region. I mean, this sale comes on the heels of a not quite so large but equally significant sale to United Arab Emirates. Of course, the Israelis have a constant flow of weapons coming from the United States. The Iranians, as we know, are buying weapons from other parts of the world. There is already a huge arms race in the region. The nuclear, whether you call it a deterrent or an offensive capacity or an ability to sort of bolster other forms of influence in the region, this dynamic is already very much in play.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned the United Arab Emirates. We're talking about weapons, for the most part, that are anti-defense systems.
Yeah, well, you know, the Emirates is, as you know, a very, very small, very, very wealthy country or set of states sitting right at the edge of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, of course, and Bahrain as well. They are truly vulnerable in a physical way that Saudi Arabia is not. And they don't have many friends outside of the region, except in many cases for the United States, and also, actually, frankly, you know, have ties to Iran. It's sort of an open secret that the port of Abu Dhabi is the place to go if you want to transship material that would otherwise be blocked by the U.S. embargo on Iran. You know, you ship it through Abu Dhabi. The lines of interest in this part of the world are, as many other places, extremely complex and highly overlapping. But I don't want anyone to walk away with the impression that this is setting off an arms race. It's in the middle of what is already a
very
active arms race.
Let me get William on here from Belvedere. William,
yes.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I've been waiting in vain for someone to deal with the money issue, and no one has. If you look on the Department of Energy website for the United States, you find that the United States is now spending $2 billion per month buying oil from Saudi Arabia. What this serves to do, the arms deal, from a money point of view, is to help the U.S. economy, and it obviously is not doing well at all, and it also stimulates what I would call the military-industrial complex by providing as obvious large stimulus money from the arms sale to the military-industrial complex, which keeps it going, which keeps the armaments going the factories going. And I would appreciate it if the guest could comment on the money thing. I don't know why that hasn't been commented upon.
Okay, we're coming up on a pledge break here. Jonathan Tepperman, quick response from you on the money scene.
Well, just that if we're hoping to use weapons to offset the amount of money that we ship to the Middle East every year for oil, we're going to have to sell a lot more than we currently are. And this package isn't going to do it as big as it is.
And you're listening to Forum. We are in a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, and we're talking with Jonathan Tepperman, who is with the Eurasia Group, and with Steve Wepper, professor of political science at Berkeley. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's get May Sam on from San Jose. Good morning.
Hi, good morning to you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I grew up in Iran, and the way I look at this is actually I think it's been brought up a few times that Iran has no interest attacking Saudi Arabia because they would actually destabilize the Sunni or Kurd population in Iran. Iran is mostly Shia, but there are minority Sunni and Kurds, and between, you know, the U.S. bases in Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Pakistan, it's Iran really, I find it hard to believe that Iran, you know, is planning an attack on any of these countries. I think at the end of the day, the arm race there is essentially, a war between, if you look at it, between Russia, China, and the U.S., because, you know, if Saudi Arabia has $60 billion, who better have it than, you know, U.S. government? Because otherwise, you would go to China or to Russia. So that was my comment. I think Russia and China have really closed up with Iran, and this is a way of, maybe subliminal messages or, in a way, drawing lines in the sand. And I'll take my answer offline.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Some interesting analysis in that, Steve Wepper. It gets back to what you said before about China. And China used, or was it you, Jonathan Tepperman? China using more oil or getting more oil now. But to some extent, we're in a kind of neo-Cold War posturing here. And that may play into the geopolitics as well, no?
Jonathan, you want to speak to that? I will if you don't.
Well, go ahead, because it was you, actually, that raised the China issue.
Yeah, I think it was Steve Wepper, right?
Okay. Yeah, look, I mean, I think from the Chinese perspective, this is a part of the world in which they need, actually, to have both a political and an economic presence of substantial weight. As I said before, their incremental oil import needs are growing much faster than ours are. The oil is in the Middle East, and at the end of the day, that's where they need to be. They very much sense the degree to which U.S. power in the region is being questioned much more aggressively than it was in the past. And, you know, that's a huge opportunity and an opening for them. So, as I said, you know, the Chinese are all over Riyadh. They're building infrastructure. They're engaging in economic development programs and buying more oil from the Saudis and the United States. I suspect that there is a degree to which this weapon sale is the U.S. throwing down a marker and saying, look, when it comes to the real core issues of national security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we're still the big boys in Riyadh. That, I suspect, is, you know, an interim kind of strategy which will buy us some time. But at the end of the day, we have to have a bigger kind of pitch to the Saudis than that.
At the end of the day, we're so in debt to the Chinese that I'm afraid that colors things as well in this whole picture. But let me go to more of your calls and get Michael on here. Michael, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for letting me join. The comment I had is, didn't Saudi Arabia do the 9/11 thing? My understanding was most of the people, 10 of them, were from Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden, who is still at large, is Saudi. I'll take my comment out there.
All right. Well, let's not confuse the Saudi Arabian kingdom with its citizens. Most of the hijackers in 9/11 were indeed Saudis. Bin Laden was of Yemen. His family was from Yemen, though he lived most of his life in Saudi Arabia. But there's still that element in all this, Jonathan Tepperman, isn't there, to some degree?
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out insofar as it's worth remembering this issue that we were discussing earlier in the program, which is that this is a regime that's very much under threat, and it's there's no guarantee that the government that we're sending these weapons to is the government that will always be in charge of the country. And among the threats that this very small, not very legitimate government has to contend with is a serious Islamist one.
Steve Weber, something to add on that score?
Yeah, I think this is a long-standing issue in our relationship with the Saudis. Again, I think it's fundamentally grounded in the reality of the demography of the country. You know, a very small number of very rich folks running the country, and a very large number of unemployed youth who are basically looking for something to do. And you know, there is no better place to do recruiting for al-Qaeda than inside Saudi Arabia. So I can only agree with what Jonathan said. This is an unstable regime. Probably the question we should be asking ourselves is, does this arms sale impact positively or negatively on the stability of the regime? And, you know, I think at best it's a crapshoot.
Well, we've got seconds left. Jonathan Timmerman, despite what we heard from Congressman Sherman, pretty much fait accompli, this deal is going to be done.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the sweet irony of the fact that Congress is looking at this skeptically is it's another demonstration of the fact that there are times when the U.S. Congress is more hawkish on Israel questions than the Israeli government itself is. If Israel is blessing this, I can't imagine that Congress is going to get in the way.
Thank you, Jonathan Tepperman. Thank you, Steve Weber. We also thank Brad Sherman, congressman from the 27th District, who was with us, and Khalid Al-Mayina, editor-in-chief of the Arab News, and also Mahmoud Manshapouri, associate professor of international relations at San Francisco State. Thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. And we thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our engineer, Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.